The first echelon of the expeditionary force had consisted of the 1st Infantry Division and half of the 2nd Infantry Division, which had been split into two reinforced brigades under Eastshear and Green Valley. Simpkins' second echelon was considerably larger, three more infantry brigades, the rest of the 2nd Division and the entire 3rd Division, plus the 1st, 2nd, and 3rd Mounted Brigades, plus the remainder of the entire Expeditionary Force's artillery, engineering, and medical trains. The 3rd Mounted would be on its way to reinforce Green Valley within the 5-day, as soon as its horses had regained their land legs after the voyage from Ravensland. Simpkin, with the 3rd Infantry Division and the 1st and 2nd Mounted, would be dispatched to reinforce Eastshear just as rapidly, but the 4th Infantry Brigade would be headed somewhere else entirely. His eyes moved down the East Haven coast and through the Tarrow Channel to where another Sidermarkian flag stood out of the map's surface at a small dot labeled Thesmar, and he smiled.
"A moment, please, Merlin."
Merlin turned down to look as Iva Parson laid a hand on his elbow. The meeting had finally broken up, although Caleb and Stonar were still discussing something with Maiden, and he cocked an eyebrow. "And how may I serve you, my lady?" She shook her head at his gently teasing tone. It was something of a joke between them, although he doubted she'd recognize the sincerity with which he used it. Unlike any of the Sidermarkians in this room, he knew she'd been more than entitled to that form of address by birth, or would have been if her father had ever acknowledged his daughter. Nor did any of those Sidermarkians realize she'd been reared as the adopted daughter of one of the Church of God Awaiting's powerful dynasties, even without that acknowledgement. They had no idea of the personal sacrifices she'd made, the world of privilege upon which she'd turned her back in the name of a greater responsibility and her own fierce beliefs.
"I've been reading the most recent reports from some of your agents in the Temple Lands," she said. "I know you and His Majesty see copies of most of them, and there's a point in one of the most recent which probably needs clearing up."
"Huh?" He raised an eyebrow, and she grimaced. It was a very graceful grimace, no doubt the well-trained product of her avocation, and very attractive it looked on her beautiful face. At the same time, he suspected there might be a trace of embarrassment, perhaps, behind it.
"Yes, well, it's the one from Sajin Joshua."
"Oh, that report," he murmured. Joshua Murphy was another Abram Jevons, although Merlin had physically impersonated the fair-haired, gray-eyed Murphy only a time or two. That was because Sajin Joshua was officially stationed in Zion. Despite how cautious Merlin and Narman remained about utilizing snarks in the vicinity of the temple itself, much of the city could be safely covered by the remotes, and Murphy picked up quite a lot of information simply by listening to conversations outside the danger zone. Including... "I assume you're referring to those rumors he's reported," he continued after a moment.
"Yes," she acknowledged.
"And would it happen that you're bringing this up because there's a kernel of truth behind those rumors?"
"Yes,"
she sighed.
"In fact, there's quite a substantial kernel of truth behind them."
"I see." He regarded her for a few more heartbeats, his head cocked. "How many?" he asked.
9,
she said, and shrugged.
"It was almost 10, but Vicar Nicodemus changed his plans at the last moment."
9, he repeated carefully, and felt both eyebrows rise when she nodded. That was more than he'd estimated. Clinton and Reno must be doing a better job of suppressing the news than he'd expected. "May one inquire as to exactly how you've managed that?" he asked politely. "I assume it was you, since no one else with the reach and audacity to assassinate members of the Council of Vicars comes readily to mind."
"Yes, it was me. Or my people, at any rate."
"And the reason you've never mentioned this little endeavor would be..."
because I wasn't certain how some of our allies would feel about murdering Vickers, no matter what sort of diseased excrescences on the human race the Vickers in question might be, she said flatly.
You mean... He waved his hand, unobtrusively indicating the other men in the conference chamber, and she shook her head.
Some of them might have a few qualms about it, but most of them... She snorted. They know who the enemy is, Merlin. I'm not worried about anyone in this room shedding any tears of remorse over a few discreet assassinations in Zion. But the only way to keep a secret really secret is to not tell anyone else about it. And this is one endeavor I don't want leaking prematurely. So far, the only one who's officially killed any members of the Vicarate is Jaspar Clintarne, and he's justified it by trumping up that travesty of an investigation and waving around a handful of tortured confessions.
Her lovely face turned grim for a moment, hard as glacier-hard granite.
As soon as word gets out that someone's assassinating Vickers, Clintarne and Raynor will use it to whip up outrage among the Temple Loyalists. They might even be able to convince some reformists that actually killing men consecrated to the Orange is going a step too far. So, as long as he's willing to suppress the news rather than admit the Vicarate's vulnerability, I'm perfectly prepared to go along from our side as well. And even leaving that aside, there are operational considerations. My people in Zion are living on a knife's edge, Merlin. I'm the only one who knows how to contact them, and I do that as infrequently as possible. I intend to keep it that way, and if more people learned they exist, I'm afraid there'd be pressure to use them for more general spying or micromanage.
She smiled briefly as she used the word Merlin and Caleb had introduced into the Allies' lexicon, their targeting.
I'm not saying the pressure would be irrational, given the situation, but it would place them at far greater risk. Every time I send them a message, I put them in danger, and trying to coordinate or control their operations from here would require me to do that far more often.
She regarded him levelly.
I'm not prepared to do that. I won't do that.
I see. Merlin considered what she'd said, and what she hadn't. He didn't doubt she'd contacted them as infrequently as she could, especially since he still hadn't caught her at it, even with the benefit of his snarks. But clearly there was at least some communications flow in the opposite direction, given her ability to keep track of her people's accomplishments, and he found himself wondering how that flow was managed. He started to ask, but didn't.
May I ask if you have a specific targeting criterion, other than the ability to get to them? He asked instead. The priority list was drawn up based on some of that information Adderai delivered to Archbishop Michael and on some more personal considerations of my own. But each operation has to be carefully evaluated and planned, and access is a critical part of that planning. That and escape routes afterward.
Her voice dropped, and she looked away.
We've lost some people since they began active operations anyway, but none of them have been taken alive.
Merlin's face tightened, remembering a locket Angelic Fonda had worn around her neck, even in her own bed, and laid a hand on her shoulder.
Why, Iva? He asked quietly. Because someone has to, she said flatly. The vermin on that list represent everything that's wrong with the Church, every perversion, every degradation, every self-serving debasement. They use the power of the Church, the mantle of God himself, to steal and corrupt and victimize, and Clintarne and Raynor use what they know about them to buy their acquiescence in murder and atrocities.
Her dark eyes were cold, bottomless, the eyes of a slash lizard or a kraken.
My people don't have the power of the Temple Guard or the reach of the Inquisition. They can't move openly, just as no one dares to openly criticize Clinton's butchery. But every one of his creatures we kill weakens his and Reyno's grip on the rest of the Vicarate, be it ever so slightly. Who knows? The Archangels promise us miracles. Maybe even some of the pigs swilling at Clinton's trough will mend their ways if we kill enough of the others. And if they don't?
She looked up at him, and her smile was even colder than her eyes.
If they don't, at least the world will be a little better place, and hell will have a few new tenants. That has to count for something, Merlin.
Chapter 2. Telesburg Palace, City of Telesburg, Kingdom of Old Karras, Empire of Karras.
You're late.
Baron Ironhill skewered Edward Hausman with a stern eye as the Ironmaster entered the airy council chamber. The warm breeze sweeping through the open windows plucked playfully at the edges of sheets of paper, and the Empire of Karras's treasurer shook a finger.
This sort of persistent tardiness will not be tolerated, Master Hausman.
Hausman made a rude gesture with his right hand and sauntered, positively sauntered, to his own chair.
I'm devastated by your displeasure, my lord, he told his old friend,
and Ironhill chuckled. He'd been doing more of that in the last few 5 days.
I'm sure you are. Nonetheless, you are...
The Baron pulled out his watch and examined it.
No less than 6 minutes late. I trust there's an explanation.
I stopped by the broken pot,
Hausman replied serenely.
I've got a hangover, too, so if you could moderate your volume, I'd appreciate it deeply.
Ironhill shook his head and restored his watch to his pocket, then glanced around the table at the other two men present.
Don't look at me.
Sir Dominic Stainer told him.
If I had my druthers, I'd be in the broken pot right now, too.
The High Admiral, who looked more like his brother every day as his hair grew progressively more silver, shifted the wooden peg which had replaced his lower right leg on its footstool.
Nothing I like better than endless shoreside meetings.
You're a sad, sad influence, Admiral Rookpoint,
Travis Olson observed. Olson, the Earl of Pine Hollow and the Empire's first counselor, was Narman Bates's cousin, although he was as wiry as Narman had been plump, and his brain was very nearly as sharp. He was also, like Hausman and Rockpoint, but not Ironhill, a member in good standing of the Inner Circle.
And I never suspected you old Carisians were such hedonists. We're not,
Ironhill growled.
Some of us are sots, though. Really?
Pine Hollow cocked his head in a gesture which reminded all of them of his cousin.
Odd that I'd never noticed. However, now that we have all of that out of our systems, what say we do a little work for a change?
The others chuckled, although there was more than a trace of sourness in the amusement, given the schedules the four of them maintained.
Alvino, the first counselor went on, since everything we're going to be talking about has to do with money, one way or the other, why don't you take the chair?
Fair enough.
Ironhill nodded to the Earl and then leaned back in his well-cushioned armchair, regarding Hausman rather more seriously.
I know Dominic's scheduled for more meetings down at the dockyard this afternoon, Edward, and I understand,
his smile turned suddenly cold and satisfied, that you and Earl Nerowak have an appointment to discuss the terms for winding up Stuart Choel's liquidation.
I'm looking forward to the Treasury's share of that, and not just because I can always use the marks. Since we all have so much on our plates, though, I thought we'd start with the two of you. Travis and I can discuss the business that doesn't involve you after you've left.
Sounds good to me,
Hausman agreed.
I stopped by King's Harbour on my way down from Delphac to get the latest update from Alfred and Captain Roswell. But first, I brought this.
He placed a heavy, varnished box on the table before him and opened it.
Ah.
Rockpoint's eyes lit, and Hausman smiled at him.
No, you don't get this one,
he told his friend.
This one is the third one ever made. It's intended for the Emperor, and it'll be leaving for Siddar City with the next packet boat. The first ever made, and the second one just like it, will go along to keep it company, but not to His Majesty.
Sajin Merlin?
Ironhill's eyes were bright and interested as Hausman lifted the pistol from its velvet-lined nest.
It seems appropriate, since the original was his,
Hausman pointed out, and the Baron nodded.
Of course, we've made some improvements. Master Maldon and I have 3 new patents just on the pistol. That doesn't begin to count the ones on the cartridges, the bullet-making equipment, or the new rifles. He's going to be a wealthy man before this is all over.
Undeservedly so, Pine Hollow murmured.
Absolutely,
Hausman agreed with total sincerity. He'd steered Tigus Maldon subtly, but all the major features of the new weapon and its ammunition had been devised by the head of the Delthak Works pistol shop, and the final result was even better than he'd hoped. The new revolver had a solid frame with a swing-out cylinder rather than the removable cylinder of Merlin's original cap-and-ball design. It was beautifully made, with polished checkered grips of dark, satiny Safeholdian teak inlaid with golden medallions bearing the arms of the House of Armagh.
"This is the extractor rod,"
Hausman said as he swung the cylinder wide and touched the rod protruding from its front. When the cylinder was locked in place, the rod fitted into a protective shroud under the weapon's 6-inch barrel.
"When you press it like this," he demonstrated, "it moves through the center of the cylinder, and this star-shaped extractor catches under the cartridge's rims and clears all 6 empty chambers in a single stroke."
He laid the pistol aside and reached into his briefcase for a pair of bright, hollow brass cylinders. The shorter was a bit over 1 inch long, while the longer measured almost exactly 2 inches, but both seemed to be the same diameter, and he stood them on end beside each other.
"These are handmade, and you don't want to know how long it would take to produce worthwhile amounts of ammunition that way. Fortunately, we won't have to, and these work fine for testing purposes and to provide the Sajin enough rounds to play with. They're both 45 caliber, and this,"
he picked up the shorter of the two,
"pushes a 350-grain bullet out of a 6-inch barrel at approximately 1,000 feet per second. That's actually about 50 feet per second faster than the standard infantry Mondrain, the Mark IIA, and only about 30 feet per second lower than the Mark IIB, the sniper version. As nearly as we can calculate it, this round's initial muzzle energy is virtually identical with the Mark IIA's, though, because of the rifle's heavier bullet."
Ironhill's eyebrows rose in surprise, and Hausman smiled. Then he picked up the second, longer cartridge.
"This is the round for what we're calling the Model 96 Mondrain, from its year of introduction. That's the official name. Most of us at Delthak just call it the M96 for short. The extra case length is necessary because the powder charge is better than twice as heavy as the revolvers. It's a smaller diameter than the 50-caliber round of the existing rifles, but it fires a longer bullet that's actually 30% heavier. Well, it's lighter than the sniper rifles, actually, but we're using the same round and rifling in all the versions of the Model 96, and using the same caliber in the revolvers and the new rifles will simplify case production. For that matter, it'll give us some advantages in bullet production, despite the differences between the bullets' weights and ballistic profiles. We're going to have to set up 2 separate ammunition production lines when we convert the existing Mark II rifles, because it turns out the new round's properties are incompatible with the older weapons. In fact, they're different enough that the M96 needs a completely different and deeper pattern of rifling. We've also decided against providing the conversions with magazines. Tigus came up with a design for them. He calls it a trap-drawer design, because it uses a hinged block that swings up that still constitutes a huge improvement and shortens the conversion process to less than 1/4 of the time to build them from scratch. Settling for a single shot will make them tactically inferior to the M96, but it will take 3 times as long to convert them to magazines. And while I know this may upset Dominic, what I'm thinking is that as we convert the existing Mondrains, we withdraw them from service with the Marines, where pitched combat is less likely, and supply the new M96s to the Army. If we get production up to the levels I'm anticipating, we should be in a position to retire them entirely within 1 or 2. In fact, we might be able to pass them directly to Sidamark rather than to the Marines as soon as they're converted.
I'm always happy to hear about ways to not spend money, so your conversion idea sounds great to me,
Ironhill said.
By the same token, though, if we pass the conversions to Sidamark, will you be able to produce enough ammunition to supply the Republic as well as our own troops?
He shook his head.
And while I understand there are huge tactical advantages in the new weapons, won't adopting these metallic cartridges of yours mean we can't use paper cartridges anymore, or captured temple gunpowder?
That's already true with the Mondrains, Alvino,
Stainer pointed out.
They rely on primer caps.
He shrugged.
If we run out of caps, we're SOL, to use His Majesty's charming term. Dominic's right,
Hausman agreed.
And the new machinery will produce ammunition more rapidly than our existing arrangements, since it's going to combine the old paper cartridge and the primer cap in a single package. The ammunition will be safer to handle, too, and while using brass cases will push up material costs, compared to the paper, the man-hours per round will go down considerably. Overall, the metallic rounds will actually cost the Treasury less.
Ironhill considered that for a moment, then nodded in acknowledgement, and Hausman went on.
The round may be the same caliber as the revolvers, but the bullet's much heavier. 500 grains, not 300. And the M96's muzzle velocity will be almost 600 feet per second higher than the revolver's. That's why the case is so long. Getting that kind of performance out of black powder requires a heavy charge, and we're using what Tigis calls pelletized powder. The same thing Alfred's calling prismatic powder for the artillery, on a smaller scale, as well. As you can see, the bullet itself is the same basic shape as the Mark IIb's.
He touched the tip of the bullet, which would have been called a Spitzer point back on old Earth.
It has the same boat-tail design, too, and Tigis...
And Owl, he carefully did not add aloud,
came up with something he calls a gas jig. It's basically a copper disc at the base of the bullet to prevent the propellant charge from melting the lead. Our test firings indicate that with that and a lubricant to protect the sides of the bullet from melting as well, we get higher muzzle velocities and better accuracy without the kind of lead fouling we experienced when we pushed the velocity on the Mark IIb this high. We're using the same water-quenching process we came up with for the sniper weapons, and after trying several alloys, we've found that adding false silver seems to give us the best combination of hardness and workability. At any rate, according to the ballistic pendulum, this round generates 3.5 times the muzzle energy of the revolver round, and because of its shape and greater weight, it maintains that velocity to a much greater range. According to Dr. Markland's calculations, this round will have roughly the same striking power at 950 yards that the standard revolver has at 250. Of course,
the industrialist grinned suddenly.
I don't imagine anyone besides Sajin Merlin's going to score any hits with revolvers at that kind of range. Oh, I don't know,
Rockpoint said with a slow smile of his own.
I imagine Sajin Abraham might pull it off as well. All right, I'll grant you Sajin Abraham. Most mere mortals won't, though.
Probably not,
the Admiral conceded.
That sounds really impressive, Ironhill said. I thought you and Alfred wanted to wait for this new gun cotton Dr. Lewis is working on, though. I hate to sound like a mark pincher, and I know we're one hell of a lot better off than we were 3 months ago, but that's my job. And unless we're very lucky, I'm going to be looking at Shan Wei's own inflation in prices once the new mines actually start producing.
He shook his head.
I don't think even Desnair's ever had a situation quite like this one.
The others nodded, although Hausman wondered if Pine Hollow and Rockpoint found it as hard to suppress their smiles as he did. The fact that Ironhill knew about Sajin Merlin's visions had made things surprisingly simple after Prince Narman dropped his little Silverlode Island surprise. Merlin had simply sent a letter to Pine Hollow giving him the location of the deposit, the first deposit, that was. With an estimate of its extent, Ironhill had been willing to accept because everything else Merlin had ever told him had been accurate. And in this case, he'd been very happy. One might even have said delighted to take Merlin's word, since Narman's comparison to Old Earth's Comstock load actually understated the case. In fact, Merlin had understated the real numbers to Ironhill in turn. Lest even the Baron's faith in the Sage Inn's visions prove insufficient this time around. The Moria Mountains, which formed the huge island's mountainous spine, covered an area 70% greater than the ancient North American state of Texas, and were home to at least 4 major ore lodes, which Shan Wei had somehow failed to mention to Langhorne and his command crew. The most accessible, which was not the richest, was between 80 and 90% as large as the Comstock, and, like that strike, consisted of both gold and silver bonanza ore, layers of ore in discrete masses, up to hundreds of feet in depth in spots, and soft enough it could be cut out with a shovel. The Comstock lode had produced almost 7 million tons of silver and gold ore in a 20-year span. This one would produce less, but a higher percentage of it would be gold. Shan Wei's data included a highly accurate estimate of the ore body's extent, and the total production from what had already been labeled the Moira lode was likely to top 4 million tons of silver and almost 2.5 million of gold. Given the richness of the ore, that would come to a tidy total of just over 10 trillion 896 marks. It wouldn't all be coming in at once. Indeed, it would take months for the first shaft to be sunk, even knowing exactly where to begin, but it promised to provide a handy little nest egg. And, as Iron Hill had said, it also promised to inflate prices badly if Karis was careless about how it was dumped into the economy, which made it fortunate the entire island was effectively the House of Armok's private property. Caleb and Charlian could determine exactly how much of that gold and silver came out of the ground at any one time, and in the meantime, Iron Hill had begun issuing interest-bearing promissory notes at 6% compound interest with 10-year expiration dates. That meant each of them would be worth 180% of face value when they were redeemed, which, coupled with Karis's reputation, was good enough for most people to take the notes even before the new ore strike was made public. "I do have to keep reminding myself not to run wild with all that promised wealth," Iron Hill continued. "And I'm still robbing Peta to pay Powell in too many cases while we wait for it to start pouring in, too. So I have to ask if it's really worthwhile to introduce an entirely new round loaded with black powder if we're just going to turn around and change everything as soon as the new propellants become available."
"That's really a two-part question, Alvino."
Hausman picked up the rifle round, cupping it in the palm of his hand.
"The first is how quickly the new propellants will become available, and the answer there is that it won't be as soon as we'd hoped."
He grimaced and closed his hand on the cartridge.
"They seem to have a pretty good handle on what they need to do. The problem is figuring out how to do it, especially in quantity, and that's going to take several more months. We should have the first revolver production line up in the next few 5 days, though, and we'll be ready to start conversion on the Mark IIs about the same time. Since we're using the revolver to prototype my new assembly process, it's going to be the end of October or so before we start up the first M96 line. But Dr. Lewis's current estimate is that it'll be sometime late next spring or even early summer before we can produce gun cotton-loaded cartridges. I don't think we can justify not putting the black powder rounds into production in the interim. At the same time, there's no question that when they do become available, there'll be a significant improvement over this round."
He opened his hand to show the shiny brass cartridge again.
"Our best estimate from the numbers Dr. Lewis and Dr. Macklin can give us is that with gun cotton, the M96's muzzle velocity will be close to 1,000 feet per second higher than with black powder, and without the huge volumes of smoke. We can't take full advantage of the longer-range accuracy and hitting power this cartridge theoretically makes available, because black powder produces so much smoke, visibility is obscured. That won't happen with the new propellants."
Iron Hill was nodding slowly, expression thoughtful, and Hausman shrugged.
"We're taking the new powder into consideration in these designs," he said,
setting the rifle cartridge back on the table beside the pistol round.
"For example, one reason to go to a completely new design is that while the steel in the Mark II's much better than anyone had a few years ago, the steel we can produce now is even better. And that's a significant factor when we start talking about the sort of muzzle velocities gun cotton's going to make possible. We could go on using alloyed bullets at those velocities, but it'll probably make more sense to gild them with something with a higher melting point, like copper. We'd considered that for these rounds, but copper's one of our bottlenecks. and demand is already going to increase when we go to the metallic cartridges. In fact, we actually looked at steel cartridges instead, but brass has superior expansion and elasticity. At any rate, once the gun cotton propellant becomes available, we should be able to convert using the same cartridges and weapons. We'll just use lighter charges in the same cases. We'll probably go to gun cotton for the trap door mandrains as well, if only because of the smoke issue. But I wouldn't feel comfortable loading their cartridges to the same pressures and velocities as the M96 is designed to handle.
All right, that answers my questions, Iron Hill grimaced. Now all I have to do is figure out how to pay you for them. I don't suppose you'd care to provide the first, 10 or 20,000 of them as samples, would you?
I'm afraid not,
Hausman said politely.
Because you're a friend and a valued customer, I will offer you a nice discount, though. Say 2%.
Ironhill laughed.
Actually, given the number of these things we're going to be buying, a 2% discount would probably save me a fortune in the end. I guess you're worth it, though. His Majesty seems to think so, anyway.
He's not done costing you money yet, Alvino,
Rockpoint said.
Of course not. Aside from what the Treasury stands to recoup from that bastard Shoale, I never see him unless it's going to cost me money.
But, as you say, His Majesty thinks he's worth it, Pinehollow pointed out with a smile. And so, the smile faded, do the men we've deployed in the Republic.
True, Ironhill acknowledged a bit more soberly and turned back to Hausman. So what does Dominic have in mind this time?
As I said, I stopped off to talk with Alfred and Captain Roswell and Sir Dustin. The second flight of the new ironclads is a couple of 5 days behind schedule at the moment, although Commander Mulcahy and Commander Hainai expect to make that up. Part of the problem was that last load of wrought iron from Shoale, frankly.
The industrialist grimaced, then gave himself a shake.
Anyway, we're in decent shape where they're concerned, but production of the new guns is running ahead of schedule. We already had quite a few gun tubes, now mount production's catching up, and the weapons for the improved River-class ships will be ready well before the ships themselves are. Half the new hulls are already afloat or ready for launch, but it's going to be at least a month before the first one commissions, and I already have enough of the new guns to arm the first flight of the new ships and replace the 30-pounders aboard the original ironclads. I'd really like to go ahead and send the extras off to Sittermark in the next convoy.
Dominic? Pinehollow looked at the High Admiral.
Suits me,
Rockpoint snorted.
Worst case, the last half dozen of the improved rivers are delayed a month or two waiting for their guns, and we get the four originals into service instead. And Shunwei knows they aren't doing anyone any good sitting in an ordnance warehouse here in Old Kurris.
Do you have enough of the new shells?
Ironhill asked.
That's why Dominic said I was going to cost you more money,
Hausman replied with a smile.
The new copper driving bands work even better than Alfred and Captain Roswell expected, and they've finally gotten their brown powder into production at Hyratha. When you add up the tighter, more efficient bore seal, the smoother shell body, and the ballistic qualities of the prismatic powder, the new 6-inch is probably as effective as, maybe even more effective than, the existing 8-inch. We've got enough of the new shells in inventory to provide each existing ironclad with about 90 rounds per gun, and the line's in place for volume production, but we won't have any additional ships mounting the new gun until the improved rivers begin commissioning. If we rearm the existing ships, they won't be able to fire the 6-inch round the existing angle guns do. But do we want to commit the money and the resources to starting up production when they're the only units that can use it?
Dominic? Pinehollow asked again, and the High Admiral nodded sharply.
Definitely.
His voice was flat, positive.
One thing Edward didn't mention is that he's ready to begin production on the new angle guns as well, and they'll fire the same shell. We'll start by converting the existing tubes to the new mounts, but there's no point continuing to build stud-rifled barrels if a better design's available. We're going to need lots of angle gun shells down the road, and not all that far down the road. That's reason enough from the logistic perspective to get that line of his fired up, and even if it weren't, The tactical consequences of getting the new guns to Barnes and the other ships in the Republic would more than justify it. I know funding's always an issue, Alvino, but this is one spider rat hole that definitely needs money poured down it.
All right, Ironhill sighed. Consider your point made. He jotted a note on the pad at his elbow, then looked up again. And the King Haralds?
Dustin's finished playing with the redesign in light of Captain Barnes's after-action report, and he's laying down the first three this 5 day,
Rockpoint said.
He says 8 months to commission. His crew's learned a lot working on the ironclads, which means they should be ready for service next July. Personally, I think he'll do better than his estimate, the way he always does. But that may only be my optimism talking. I think he probably will have the hulls finished earlier than he's estimating,
Hausman agreed.
And I'm pretty sure the guns will be ready early, too. The armor's going to be a closer-run thing, though. The engines are good?
Rockpoint asked.
They're not going to cause Powell here any more anxiety. I don't believe so,
Hausman said with admirable gravity. The new engines were fiendishly expensive, and the treasurer had expressed some concern over committing funds in such quantity to yet another untried bit of technology. That had been before he knew about the Moria load, and it had been hard to blame him for his worry. The King Haralds would be the first ships powered by triple expansion machinery rather than the double expansion engines used in the smaller ironclads, and each of those engines would produce 600 shaft dragon power, which would have been 15,000 horsepower back on old Earth. More than that, the redesigned King Haralds would displace over 11,000 tons and be built without masts or sails. The notion of relying solely on steam for the ship's propulsion had more people than Ironhill a bit worried, so Olivier had provided wells and footings to mount 3 masts as a purely emergency measure. And it had better be something used only in emergencies. By Olivier's and Owl's estimate, they would be capable of no more than 2 knots in average conditions under sail, thanks to the drag their twin screws would impose.
Stallman's had the test engine up and operating continuously at 2/3 power for over a month now, he continued. Given Dustin's speed estimates, that's long enough for one of these ships to steam from here to Cherraith 2.5 times. Of course, they'd have to stop to re-coal in Zebediah if they steamed the whole way that fast, but I think the machinery's been about as well-proved as it can be before it's installed in an actual ship.
Good, Rockpoint said, and then grinned almost impishly. And now that that's settled, I think we can let you go for that meeting with Nerowak and Shawale. And don't forget this.
He picked up the revolver, returned it to its case, and handed it back to the Ironmaster.
Maybe you'll get a chance to try it out.
Chapter 3 Branath Canal, Glacierheart Province, Republic of Sidermark.
Well, it beats walking, sir, Silas Troscott said, standing at the rope and stanchion arrangement which served as a railing. Not so sure about the direction, though.
Burke Ryman, Colonel Burke Ryman, of the 1st Glacierheart Volunteers, stepped up beside him, gazing over the side at the muddy brown water of the Branath Canal's southbound lane. The northbound lane was occupied by an identical barge, also headed south, its deck and low superstructure covered by seated Carisian infantry busily cleaning weapons and sharpening bayonets.
How, he wondered, did a good Carisian boy end up a colonel in the Republic of Sidermark Army in command of a regiment of bloody-minded Glacierheart miners and mountain clansmen? Talk about herding cat lizards! The hard-headed, independent, self-sufficient citizens of Glacierheart would have been a handful under any circumstances. Their sense of almost implacable self-reliance and stubborn integrity went a long way towards explaining why and how the reformist-minded folk of Glacierheart had crushed the rebellious Temple Loyalist militia which had attempted to seize the province as part of the Sword of Shuler.
The bitterness and atrocities of the winter mountain warfare against the temple loyalists of Hildermoss had only honed that iron-ribbed determination and burnished it with an edge of ferocity, and a deep, burning hatred which was rare among the mountaineers. A third of the men who'd enlisted in the 1st Glacier Heart Volunteers were mountain trappers and hunters like Captain Wallace Mockham. The rest were miners, farmers, and small-town artisans, and all of them tended to be very tough customers. Mining was always a dangerous, brutal occupation, and farming in Glacier Heart was no picnic. While most of the artisans in question had themselves come out of the mines or off the farm before they were apprenticed in their current trades. His mountaineers, Ryman often thought, might possess the closest thing Siddermark had ever produced to the legendary toughness of Harchongese serfs, but there was a vast difference between them and the stolid, almost animal-like endurance of the Harchongians. They didn't take well to military discipline, his Glacier Harters. When it came to orders, especially in combat, they were fine. They showed a bit less interest in maintaining smart formations, salutes, proper military courtesy, or any of the other 101 things that differentiated a professional soldier from a civilian off the battlefield. On the other hand, miners were accustomed to working conditions where their lives often depended on discipline, both their own and that of their fellow miners, and they had a short way with anyone whose lack of discipline threatened the unit's actual functionality. In fact, the punishment they handed out was almost always more severe even than the famed discipline of the Republic of Siddermark Army's regulars. Tough or not, it was a very rare Glacier Harter who committed the same infraction twice once his mates had reasoned with him, and once he got back out of the infirmary, of course. The regulars, even the Carisian regulars, had been inclined to look down upon the 1st Glacier Harts at first. The handful of Brigadier Tyson's surviving Marines had been quick to set the record straight, however, and the high percentage of hunters and trappers in Ryman's regiment made it particularly well-suited to the sort of light infantry tasks at which the Army of God was least adroit. In fact, Duke Eastshire had started using the volunteers for jobs he would normally have assigned to his scout snipers.
The fact that my miners and canal builders are more accustomed to working with explosives than most people doesn't hurt any either, Ryman thought with grim amusement. Wallace especially took to planting sweepers and fountains with genuine artistry. I only wish there weren't so many times I worried about what's going on inside him.
He sighed, mouth tightening as he thought about Wallace Mockham's slaughtered family. Too many of his volunteers could have told the same story, and he knew he was going to have trouble preventing the kind of counter-atrocities Eastshire was trying to avoid. He only hoped the Duke would remember what Glacier Heart had endured. And he also hoped the Duke knew what he was doing, pulling so much combat power out of Glacier Heart. At the moment, the 1st Glacier Heart volunteers and the rest of Eastshire's column were halfway between Glacierbourne Lake and Fort St. Clair, skirting the western face of the Clinmare Hills. That was a long way from the Glacier Heart Gap, and he hoped like hell the forces Eastshire had left behind were up to keeping the Army of Glacier Heart out of the province for which it had been named. They probably were, but probably wasn't a word Burke Ryman was fond of when it came to the safety of the people he'd spent the last half year of his life defending. They were important to him, and he would rip the throat out of anyone who threatened them with his bare hands.
Calmly, Burke, he told himself. Calmly.
The Duke knows what he's doing, and even if he hasn't actually told you what he has in mind, you've got a pretty good idea, don't you? After all, there's a reason he told you to make sure you had plenty of picks and shovels.
And explosives, of course.
Chapter 4. St. Kilmon's Foundry, City of Zion, the Temple Lands. Brother Lincoln Fulton looked up from his pad of notes as Vicar Elaine McGuire strode into his office. Nights were already unpleasantly chill in the northern Temple Lands. There had been ice in some of the fountains come dawn, and the day remained distinctly cool.
In short, it was a typical early September morning in Zion, despite which Fulton, who'd been born in the high foothills of the Mountains of Light, had his office windows open. Fortunately, the breeze through them wasn't strong enough to be a problem for Meguiar's more temperate sensibilities, but it carried the whiff of coal smoke and hot iron, the clangor of hammers on anvils, and the louder, slower, rhythmic thud of water-driven drop hammers. St. Kilmon's foundry wasn't actually in the precincts of Zion, but it was close enough to come under the city's direct jurisdiction, and it had been growing rapidly for the past several years. By now, it was the largest single industrial operation in the Temple Lands, although the Inquisition's reports all suggested that its output remained dismally short of the heretic Hausmann's accursed Delthac works. Meguiar was grateful for the estimated production figures, depressing though they might be, although he could wish Clinton's agent's inquisitor might have provided a little more insight into how Hausmann was accomplishing such feats. That would undoubtedly have been asking too much, of course. The heretics clearly understood the necessity of maintaining security about their capabilities, so it was understandable if the Inquisition found it difficult to obtain that information, especially from someplace as distant and which had demonstrated such fiendishly good counterintelligence as the Kingdom of Caris. He would have felt happier, however, if he'd been able to convince himself that was the only reason so little of that information was available.
Jaspar's tendency to pick and choose what he decides to tell the rest of us about is going to get all of us killed, he thought grimly. It was bad enough when I only thought that was what he was doing. Now that I've got proof...
He chopped that thought off with the efficiency of long practice. He had a suspicion this conference was going to come close enough to the fringes of what Clinton would consider allowable, or even tolerable, without adding that to the fire, and while no ears except his and Fulton should be privy to their conversation, it was far safer to assume otherwise. If the Grand Inquisitor was keeping a King Wyvern's eye on what the heretics were up to, he was keeping an even closer one on what Mother Church's loyal sons were doing. It would never do to allow Shanwei's corruption to sneak past him after all.
Even if it does risk losing the Jihad, and even if Jaspar knows as well as I do, or damn well should anyway, that Shanwei's had precious little to do with anything that's happened since...
Another thought it was best to strangle at birth, he reminded himself, and nodded to Fulton.
Brother Lincoln.
Your Grace. Fulton stood, bowing, and then bent to kiss the ring Meguiar extended across the desk to him. That desk was awash in a sea of paper, with an island of bare wood in its center to make space for Fulton's notepad, a silver tray bearing a bottle of increasingly rare Chisomian whiskey, and a pair of cut crystal glasses. Its top was scarred with old burn marks where Fulton had set an overheated pipe bowl to cool while he puzzled over the latest cryptic hints of the heretic's capabilities, and there were rings to mark where glasses had been set and left. The edge of one stack of paperwork was stained brown where he'd spilled a cup of tea, and the scent of his tobacco, a bit stale but fragrant, permeated the very fabric of the paper and clung to the walls and upholstery, even the window curtains, despite the breeze and the tang of burning coal. It was a comfortable workspace, untidy as a dragon's cave, but with the aura of a place where someone with an active, agile mind exercised it regularly.
And a damn good thing, too, Meguiar thought, watching Fulton uncap the whiskey and pour for both of them.
He hadn't asked if the vicar wanted the whiskey. By now it was an established ritual, and Meguiar sipped appreciatively.
That's good,
he said with a sigh, and Fulton nodded. Neither commented on just how rare Chisomian whiskey and Carisian-manufactured goods had become in the Temple Lands. Even the Carisian-built farm equipment was breaking down, and more precious capacity and craftsmen had to be diverted to repairing it and away from the Jihad.
Well, that particular problem's going to ease a bit when the snow begins to fly, isn't it, Elaine?
The vicar thought sourly.
Of course it'll be back to bite us on the arse even harder come spring. So,
He set his glass on the desk before him, laying his hands on either side and trapping it in the diamond of his touching thumbs and index fingers.
"Your message said you've reached some conclusions, brother."
"Some, Your Grace," Fulton acknowledged.
"To be honest, quite a few of my conclusions are a matter of agreeing with young Zhueger and Gorath. The boy has an excellent mind. I could use him here."
Their eyes met, and Maguire's nostrils flared.
"I agree with you about Lieutenant Zhueger," he said after a moment. "I think he's doing excellent work where he is, though, and we need someone like him in Dolar, as well as here. I'd rather not put all our assets in one basket."
Fulton looked back at him for a moment, then nodded. Everything Maguire had just said was true, but both of them understood his last sentence was the real reason for leaving Denis Zhueger where he was, far away from the Grand Inquisitor and with Bishop Stifon to keep a protective eye on him.
"Well, at any rate, the lieutenant's done his usual excellent job of writing up his observations and conclusions," Fulton said after a moment, looking down at the top sheet of his pad.
"His comments about the interchangeability of the parts of the heretic's new rifles match my own observations. I think he's also correct to argue that it depends on a truly universal set of measurements. Unfortunately, establishing something like that would be far more difficult than might first appear. I think it's likely the heretics have spent years in the effort, and my own observations suggest it isn't yet completed. At the same time, it also appears that just as their Delthak works have been exporting their new practices and techniques, they've been spreading their standardized measurements with them. Unless the lieutenant and I are both badly mistaken," he glanced up to meet Maguire's eyes, "they're now far enough along to establish interchangeability between parts from even widely separated manufactories. That's going to increase their production rates still more, and it's also going to significantly improve serviceability levels in the field for them. As just one example of that, their armorers won't have to individually make replacement parts when some component of a rifle breaks. They can carry stocks of the parts most likely to fail and simply replace them when they do."
He paused until Maguire nodded in glum understanding, then continued.
"As I say, I'm certain that process has taken them years, and, frankly, we can't duplicate it soon enough to affect the Army of God's situation in Sidamark, nor is that the only problem we face. To be honest, Your Grace, I hadn't followed the implications of the heretic's extensive use of steel, where we use iron, or, for that matter, of the quality of their iron, and the extent to which they've clearly refined their forging and machining processes as completely as Zhueger did. The simple truth of the matter is that, as deceptively simple as the heretic's rifle design is, we can't duplicate it in the quantities we would require, and we certainly can't approach the parts interchangeability that they've achieved. I'm sorry, Your Grace, but we just can't do it."
"I was afraid of that," Maguire sighed.
"I'm not saying the situation's hopeless, Your Grace. In fact, I think very highly of young Zhueger's proposed rifle design. We can readily incorporate it into new-build weapons, and we can convert existing weapons fairly easily if we withdraw them to our central facilities. For that matter, it may be possible to equip the armorer's wagons to perform at least some conversions in the field."
"Really?"
Maguire straightened.
"Conversions will weaken the rifle's stock somewhat," Fulton cautioned, "so they'll be a bit more fragile. While I hesitate to underestimate soldiers' ability to break things, however, I don't believe it will constitute a significant drawback, and Zhueger's estimates of how much more labor and time will be required to produce his design may be overly pessimistic. He doesn't know about Talbot and the improvements he's come up with for us, and, possibly even more to the point, I'm fairly sure he's underestimated the rate at which we can produce the necessary screws.
I think he's thinking like an ironmaster's nephew, but iron may not be the best metal for them, and I suspect he hasn't properly considered all the possible sources for the workmen to make them. I won't be certain until I've had the chance to make a few inquiries, but I estimate that once Talbot and I have had the opportunity to discuss it, we could probably produce one of young Zhueger's rifles, slightly modified from his original design perhaps, in no more than twice the time required for the existing rifle. We may even be able to improve on that number, although at this point we'd clearly be wiser to err on the side of caution.
It certainly won't require more than 3 times the man-hours, however, and even that rate is 25% better than he's estimated.
Maguire nodded slowly, his eyes thoughtful, and he considered the implications of what the other man had just said, and how fortunate it was that he was in a position to say it. The truth was that Lincoln Fulton and Talbot Briers were the crown jewels of the Army of God's weapons manufacturing capability, and it was only by the Archangel's grace he had the two of them. The black-haired, bearded Fulton was a Chihirite, like Maguire himself, although he was only a lay brother. There were several reasons for that, including the fact that he'd never felt a vocation for the priesthood. More ominously, however, he'd been disciplined several times in his youth for his curiosity and willingness to question received wisdom where the accepted practices of craft and manufactory were concerned. He'd survived mainly because the received wisdom he'd been most apt to question had simply been dogmatic, unthinking responses by superiors who, irritated by his willingness to think for himself, hadn't bothered to check the actual doctrinal authorities before they quashed him. Of course, he'd only made things worse when he'd persisted in appealing to higher authority, and it turned out those dogmatic superiors were wrong. Indeed, more than one of them had creatively misconstrued the writ, or even knowingly miscited it, simply to shut him up. And they hadn't appreciated it when he went over their heads and won. None of the questions he'd raised had actually transgressed the prescriptions, but he'd managed to exasperate enough senior churchmen, infuriate might really have been a better verb, to preclude any possibility of a career in the priesthood, even if he'd wanted one. That same willingness to challenge what he saw as needlessly inefficient practices had gotten him interested in metallurgy and the development of manufactories for Mother Church. His belief that the church ought to be directly engaged in the promotion of manufactories in the temple lands had received virtually no support from the vicarate prior to the jihad, however. Maguire was aware of that. In fact, he'd been part of it, although he'd since realized that the church's natural aversion to dangerous and unrestrained innovation had been taken entirely too far. Of course, the fact that it had been cheaper to buy the manufactured goods Mother Church and the vicarate required from Carus via Sittermark without the risk of introducing that contaminating innovation into the temple lands themselves had been a factor as well. But the jihad had changed things completely. At least it had in Elaine Maguire's opinion, and in Robert Ducairne's, and the two of them had seen in Fulton the man they needed to coordinate their own manufacturing programs. It had taken them almost 2 years to convince Clinton, thanks to those youthful disciplinary hearings, but Fulton had been put in charge of St. Kilmans 3 years ago, and output had increased dramatically under his leadership. In no small part, that was as much due to the efforts of Talbot Briers as to Fulton's leadership. Briers was 13 years younger than Fulton, and as red-haired, blue-eyed, and fair as Fulton was dark. He was also taller than Fulton and clean-shaven, but his brain was just as sharp, although it worked in rather different ways. That was what made them so effective. Fulton was constantly looking at processes, concepts, new ideas, while Briers was focused on the most efficient way to accomplish any given task. The proliferation of water-powered machinery, the emulation of the hydro-reservoirs the heretics had devised, and an unceasing effort to find more efficient ways to combine the labor of St. Kilmans' workforce were all passions of his.
"Which is why I have to worry about protecting him from the Inquisition as well,"
Maguire reflected glumly, unaware of how his thoughts matched the Earl of Thirsk's. Not that Thirsk's worries would have surprised him. It was a particularly frustrating thought because there was actually nothing inherently revolutionary in Briar's circles of production, as he called them. They were simply an expansion of the traditional workshop environment, but whereas the typical pre-jihad workshop might have consisted of
two or three master gunsmiths, supported by half a dozen journeymen and another half dozen apprentices, Briar's Circles used a single master gunsmith to supervise up to 25, or in some cases, even 30 workmen and women. The guilds, needless to say, had screamed like gelded dragons at the very thought, bad enough to dilute the supply and earnings of masters and journeymen, but Briar's Circles brought in workmen from completely outside the Gunmakers Guild as well. Worse, he'd insisted they be given tasks which would have been restricted to apprentice-level guild members, and paid them less than half of what the Gunmakers Guild had previously extorted from Mother Church. And as if determined to make bad worse where the guilds were concerned, he'd brought in women and employed them on tasks which had always previously been the monopoly of accredited guildsmen. Obviously, the relatively unskilled workers he'd brought in couldn't build entire rifles and pistols the way traditionally trained gunsmiths had done it, but Briar's hadn't even tried to teach them to do that. Instead, he'd trained each of them to perform a specific task, to make a specific part or to assemble the parts made by others. He had yet to approach the interchangeability the heretics had attained, but within each of his circles, the workers quickly became a smoothly functioning team. The parts they produced weren't interchangeable with those of any other circle, but they required only minor adjusting and fitting within their own group. And production had soared. Mother Church's manufactories were far from matching the output of something like the heretic Hausmann's huge facility, but St. Kilmaan's foundry's production rate was double that of any other mainland manufactory, and there were a great many of those mainland manufactories. Meguire and Duquerne were aggressively exporting Briar's methods to every other church facility. The guild's opposition was a given, but it had become a muted opposition of late. Not that the guildsmen had suddenly discovered that their faith required them to subordinate their own interests to Mother Church's survival. It appeared, though, that however suspect the Grand Inquisitor might find the heretics' new inventions and processes, he saw nothing demonic in simple improvements in the organization of workers using traditional techniques. Not since the tide of victory in the war he'd instigated against Sidermark had been halted, at least. "St. Gregor's and St. Martha's have both instituted their own circles now," Fulton continued, "although Talbot estimates they'll take another month or so getting to the production levels we've attained here. At the same time, he's still tweaking our own circles, and we'll export anything he comes up with to enhance our productivity to the other foundries as quickly as possible. We should have all of Mother Church's manufactories reorganized by spring. And I understand we're assuming control of the Ha Chong Yi's foundries as well?"
"Yes, we are," Meguire said. "I don't know how well his circles are going to work for Ha Chongians, but we can always hope. And I think it would be a good idea to explain them to the Dalarans and Desnarians as well. The Dalarans are already over 30% more productive than we were before Talbot's changes, Your Grace," Fulton said, without, Meguire noted, mentioning his own contributions to St. Kilmaan's improved efficiency. "I'm not certain we want to disrupt their production until we've got our own reorganized fully, not just here, but in all our manufactories. It might be better to leave them where they are for now, since their production would actually drop, initially at least, while they shifted to an entirely new organization."
"And the Desnarians?"
"Your Grace, with all due respect, not even Talbot's circles are going to make a huge difference there. For that matter, I'm not certain it would even be possible to implement them effectively. I'm in favor of anything that will improve matters, of course, but their guilds are even more resistant than ours."
Meguire grunted in unhappy agreement. With a population almost 70% greater than that of the Temple Lands, the Empire actually produced fewer rifles every month, which was ridiculous. Except that it wasn't ridiculous, given the Desnarian attitude toward anything smacking of trade. The epithet Nation of Shopkeepers had been merely scornful when most mainlanders applied it to Karras. From the Empire's slave-owning aristocrats, it had been more in the nature of a scathing denunciation. and the Church's natural wariness of Carisian innovation had confirmed their attitude towards manufactories. Far better to purchase what they required from someone else than to sully their own hands and contaminate their own lands with practices any God-fearing child of Mother Church must find suspect, especially when those practices upset the traditional social balance. Tolerating the rise of a tide of common-born manufactory owners would only undermine the sense of honor, integrity, and moral ardor which were both the hallmarks and the responsibility of the nobly born. One had only to glance at Corus's mongrelization to realize that. And just to make bad worse, the Desnarian guilds liked things that way. Carisian goods might be cheaper, affordable by far more Desnarians than domestically produced goods, but what did that matter? If they produced less, they could simply charge more. And they'd forged an alliance with the aristocracy to keep an iron lock on the empire's internal markets, systematically excluding foreign competition. Not even the requirements of the jihad were going to overcome that situation anytime soon. Desnarian nobles were almost as stiff-necked and prone to nepotism as Harchongians, although they were thankfully somewhat less addicted to outright graft. The empire was a long way from the Temple Lands, and its aristocrats were less moribund than their Harchongese counterparts. They possessed a greater sense of national identity, and however inefficient they might be, they were deeply involved in the management of their realm. Rather than relying on the monolithic bureaucracy which truly governed Harchong, if those aristocrats and powerful disgruntled guilds decided to drag their feet in introducing Briers's new techniques, Desnair's already anemic output of small arms and artillery would drop still further. And the bastards would claim it's all because of our insistence on imposing techniques foreign to our own experience and practices. They may work just fine in the Temple Lands and among those barbarian Harchongians, but they're clearly totally unsuited to Desnarians. Assuming we leave Dolar where it is for now and write Desnair off entirely, what sort of production numbers are you looking at? He asked. Any figure I give you is going to be based on guesstimates, Your Grace, Fulton said. They'll be the best guesstimates I can give you, but I'm not in a position to guarantee them at this point. I understand, Brother Lincoln. And any estimate you give me will be used only internally and treated only as an estimate, Maguire assured the monk. Don't worry, he added silently. I'm not going to throw any numbers out where Jaspar's likely to hear them and decide to make you an example to encourage our other manufactory managers if we don't meet them. Well, with that proviso, Your Grace, Fulton said, turning to a page of his notepad, at the moment, we're producing approximately 24,000 rifles per month in the Temple Lands, Dolar, Desnair, Harchong, and the border states combined. We're also acquiring about 500 per month from Silkia, now that the Grand Inquisitors ruled the demilitarization provisions no longer apply to the Grand Duchy, and we can expect those numbers to climb quite a bit, although all that production's going directly to Desnair. Assuming we bring Silkia into full production and we're able to apply Talbot's methods across the board with the same proportionate increase in productivity we've seen here, production would be about 52,000 per month. I'd love to see the Harchongese numbers climb higher than that, and I think they probably would, but it's far too early to even suggest we could accomplish it. For that matter, it's entirely possible we'll be able to tweak our own production still further, but I can't promise anything of the sort at this time. Too much depends on factors I can't begin to evaluate meaningfully. Those numbers are for our present muzzle-loading design? They are, Your Grace. What I'd really like to do would be to concentrate production of the breech-loading design here in the Temple Lands, at least initially. We'll have the circles in operation sooner than anyone else, and if my projections are remotely accurate, we could produce on the order of 12,000 per month of the new weapon. Even at 52,000, it would take close to a month's production just to replace the rifles we lost in July and August, Maguire pointed out. True, Your Grace, but we'll have as many as 5 or even 6 months' production between now and next spring.
Well, between now and the northern thaw, anyway, and if my estimates are anywhere near accurate, we should be very close to that level, outside Harchong at least, and they represent no more than 12% of the total by February.
Maguire nodded, but his expression was unhappy. Every pikeman in the Army of God needed to be rearmed with a rifle if he was going to be much more than a target for the heretics, and even at Fulton's 52,000 a month, it would take over 2 months just to rearm the AOG's remaining pikemen.
Except, of course, he thought grimly, that there's no way that's going to happen if Robert's little brainstorm works.
He suppressed a grimace there was no point letting Fulton see, but Ducerne had certainly been right about how much screaming his, no, their, now, proposal was going to evoke. In fact, the commanders of the army their plans would help most were doing the loudest screaming of all, which probably proved they were on the right track. The thought made him chuckle suddenly, and Fulton looked at him very strangely. He started to explain, then shook his head and brushed the thought away. There'd be time to tell Fulton about it if, when, everyone finally bowed to the inevitable and allowed Ducerne to have his way.
What if we completely halted production of pikes and concentrated that part of our workforce on making additional rifles? He asked instead. We're not talking about the same sets of skills, Your Grace. As I say, the critical factor for the new rifle is going to be the speed at which we can turn out the necessary screws for the breech plugs. We might see another 10% increase, at least here in the Temple Lands and in Dalar. The increase would be smaller in Desnair and Harchong, although it might be worthwhile. And if we cut back on artillery production?
Maguire inquired, fully aware that his question was a counsel of desperation.
Again, it's a completely different set of workmen, Fulton replied. And frankly, Your Grace, we're going to need to answer the heretics' artillery as badly as we need to answer their infantry weapons.
Maguire grimaced, wishing he could dispute the point.
I have reached some tentative conclusions about the heretics' artillery, Fulton continued, flipping to another page. The unexploded shells and shell fragments Bishop Militant Barnaby sent back were most informative. Unfortunately, we don't have any examples of whatever the heretics are using to cause shells to detonate on impact, and their conventional fuses function exactly the same way our own do, although the powder in them burns more consistently, which is what makes them so much more reliable. Oh, there are some detail improvements we can incorporate. In particular, their screw-in metallic fuses are highly ingenious, but even if we adopt their new design, it's unlikely to make much difference unless we can also improve the powder in them. I haven't been able to determine how those man-portable angle guns of theirs work, but I've come to suspect it has as much to do with metallurgy as with anything else. Given Lieutenant Zweiger's observations about the quantity and quality of steel they're using in their small arms, I'm fairly certain the portable angle guns use high-quality steel tubes, not iron. At present, I question whether or not we could produce similar weapons in quantity, given how much heavier and thicker an iron tube would have to be, but we're looking at the possibility of designing a spring-powered launcher to fire similar shells. The range would be much shorter, but the launcher might actually weigh less, not more, which ought to make it even more portable, and they'd be even simpler and cheaper and faster to manufacture. Assuming it's possible to produce them at all, of course. That's something else I have Talbot and his staff looking into. As for the shells themselves, he flipped another page, they're definitely using studs to engage in the cannon's rifling. We could duplicate that, but I'm inclined to wonder if it might not actually be faster and cheaper to enclose the shells in a lead, call it a slipper, I suppose. I'm thinking in terms of something that would form a sort of skirt, offer a hollow base, like a rifle bullet, that would expand into shallower rifling grooves than the heretics appear to be using with their stud arrangement. If it works, it would probably mean we wouldn't need those copper things they fit to the bases of their shells. Gas seals, we should call them, I suppose. Whatever we call them, though, that's what they do. Seal the barrel behind the shell to prevent the force of the powder from escaping around it. I'm not at all certain a lead coating would work as well as I hope, but I think it should be tried.
If nothing else, lead's a lot cheaper than copper, and we wouldn't have to machine the shell base the way they do to make their gas check stay put. Whatever we do in terms of acquiring rifled artillery, though, we obviously can't cast it in bronze, Your Grace. The rifling would quickly erode into uselessness. It might last longer if it turns out we can use something softer than the heretic studs to engage it, but I can't believe it would last long enough to be practical. It might be possible to produce a harder liner that could be inserted into a bronze tube, but it would almost certainly have to be made from wrought iron, which would cost far more time and money. Why not iron? Meguiar's tone was curious, not accusatory, and Fulton shrugged. Cast iron's too brittle, Your Grace. We'd have to expand the liner to lock it in place, probably by firing a charge, and cast iron would crack when we did. We might try black iron instead. It would have most of the properties we need, and it's less expensive than wrought iron, but it still requires a 5-day or more of heat treatment, and it's trickier to ensure quality and consistency. Meguiar grimaced in understanding. Neither he nor Fulton could have explained the physics and chemistry of the process the way Edward Hausman could have, but the vicar had received a much more extensive practical education in foundry work than he'd ever wanted over the past few years. Black iron was a relatively new improvement on the cast iron which had been part of Safehold since the creation itself. It had first been developed less than 75 years ago in Dolar, where the secret of its manufacture had been zealously guarded until the Carisians, who else, discovered how to duplicate it. It took its name from the outstanding visual difference between it and regular cast iron. When a cast iron bar was broken, the exposed metal was gray in color, with white or silvery streaks throughout. When a bar of black iron broke, the fractured surface was far darker and streaked with black. Edward Hausman could have told them that was because the carbon, anywhere from 1.5 to 5%, which produced cast iron's brittleness and accounted for its gray coloration, had been converted into nodes of graphite instead. The annealing process which converted the carbon produced a far more malleable metal, suitable for the kind of hammering and forging processes which quickly fractured cast iron and with a much higher tensile strength. Indeed, in many ways it was a better material than wrought iron, and cheaper to produce to boot. Unfortunately, as Fulton said, the annealing process took time. It also required a highly experienced ironmaster, and they simply didn't have enough of those to go around.
The heretics could probably do it with a steel tube, Fulton continued, in the tone of someone making an admission he wished he didn't have to. We can't produce steel in those quantities, yet, at least. There are some hints in the most recent reports from the Inquisition that suggest the heretics have come up with an entirely new process that we might, Your Grace, be able to duplicate with more information and a little time. For now, though, I'm afraid I just don't see an affordable way to liner bronze artillery.
I'm afraid we're going to have to make it work, however expensive it is, Meguiar said unhappily. It's clear that the heretic's advantage in range and accuracy is significant.
Agreed, Your Grace. I think, though, that we're going to have to go with cast iron tubes. We're getting much better and much more consistent results out of our iron guns than we were. So much better that I'm confident we could switch completely to iron for our smoothbore artillery. And I don't think we'd have any problems, not any insurmountable ones at any rate, cutting rifling grooves into iron guns. On the other hand, bore pressures are bound to go up with the increased weight of shells like the ones the heretics are using, and we've already had far too much experience with burst iron cannon compared to bronze, simply because bronze is more elastic. That can only get worse as bore pressure increases, but I've been discussing that problem with some of my senior artificers, and we may have come up with a solution.